Cal moved forward and nudged the lurg with two fingers, making it hop off the boulder and onto his stone. He handed this to Tian, who watched with wide eyes as the lurg spun its cocoon, spitting out the wet silk and using tiny hands to shape it. That cocoon would be watertight from the inside, sealed by dried mucus, but rainwater outside would dissolve the sac. Cal smiled, then lifted the flask and drank. This was cool, clean water, which had already had the creme settle out. Creme, the sludgy brown material that fell with rainwater, could make a man sick. Everybody knew that, not just surgeons. You always let water sit for a day, then poured off the fresh water on top, and used the creme to make pottery. The lurg eventually finished its cocoon. Tian immediately reached for the flask. Cal held the flask high. "It'll be tired, Tian. It won't jump around anymore."
"Oh."
Cal lowered the flask, patting his brother's shoulder. "I put it on that stone so you could carry it around. You can get it out later." He smiled. "Or you could drop it in father's bathwater through the window." Tian grinned at that prospect. Cal ruffled the boy's dark hair. "Go see if you can find another cocoon. If we catch two, you'll have one to play with and one to slip into the bathwater." Tian carefully set the rock aside, then scampered up over the boulders. The hillside here had broken during a high storm several months back. Shattered, as if it had been hit by the fist of some enormous creature. People said that it could have been a home that got destroyed. They burned prayers of thanks to the Almighty while at the same time whispering of dangerous things that moved in the darkness at full storm. Were the void bringers behind the destruction, or had it been the shades of the lost radiance? Laurel was looking toward the mansion again. She smoothed her dress nervously. Lately she took far more care, not getting her clothes dirty as she once had. "You still thinking about war?" Cal asked.
Yes, I am."
"Makes sense," he said. "An army had come through recruiting just a few weeks back and had picked up a few of the older boys, though only after City Lord Wistio had given permission. What do you think broke the rocks here, during the high storm?"
"I couldn't say."
Cal looked eastward. "What sent the storms?" His father said no ship had ever sailed for the origin of storms and returned safely. Few ships ever even left the coast. Being caught on the open seas during a storm meant death, so the stories said. He took another sip from his flask, then capped it, saving the rest in case Tian found another lurg. Distant men worked the fields, wearing overalls, laced brown shirts, and sturdy boots. It was worming season. A single worm could ruin an entire polyp's worth of grain. It would incubate inside, slowly eating as the grain grew. When you finally opened up the polyp in the fall, all you'd find was a big fat slug the size of two men's hands. And so they searched in the spring, going over each polyp. Where they found a burrow, they'd stick in a reed tipped with sugar, which the worm would latch onto. You pulled it out and squished it under your heel, then patched the hole with creme. It could take weeks to properly worm a field, and farmers usually went over their hills three or four times, fertilizing as they went. Cal had heard the process described 100 times over. You didn't live in a town like Hearthstone without listening to men gripe about worms. Oddly, he noticed a group of older boys gathering at the foot of the hills. He recognized all of them, of course. Jost and Jest, brothers, Mord, Tift, Nagat, Cav, and others. They each had solid Alethi Dark Eyes names. Not like Kaladin's own name. It was different. "Why aren't they worming?" he asked.
"I don't know,"
Laurel said, shifting her attention to the boys. She got an odd look in her eyes.
"Let's go see."
She started down the hillside before Cal had a chance to object. He scratched his head, looking toward Tian. "We're going down to the hillside there." A youthful head popped up behind a boulder. Tian nodded energetically, then turned back to his searching. Cal slipped off the boulder and walked down the slope after Laurel. She reached the boys, and they regarded her with uncomfortable expressions. She'd never spent much time with them, not like she had with Cal and Tian. Her father and his were pretty good friends, for all that one was light-eyed and the other dark. Laurel took a perch on a nearby rock, waiting and saying nothing. Cal walked up. Why had she wanted to come down here if she wasn't going to talk to the other boys?
Oh, Jost, Cal said.
Senior among the boys at 14, Jost was nearly a man, and he looked it, too. His chest was broad beyond his years, his legs thick and stocky, like those of his father. He was holding a length of wood from a sapling that had been shaved into a rough approximation of a quarterstaff.
Why aren't you worming?
It was the wrong thing to say, and Cal knew it immediately. Several of the boys' expressions darkened. It was a sore point to them that Cal never had to work the hills. His protests, that he spent hours upon hours memorizing muscles, bones, and cures, fell in uncaring ears. All they saw was a boy who got to spend his days in the shade while they toiled in the burning sun.
"Old Tarn found a patch of polyps that ain't grown right," Jost finally said, shooting a glance at Laurel.
"Let us go for the day while they talked over whether to try another planting there or just let them grow and see what comes of it."
Cal nodded, feeling awkward as he stood before the nine boys. They were sweaty, the knees of their trousers stained with creme and patched from rubbing stone. But Cal was clean, wearing a fine pair of trousers his mother had purchased just a few weeks before. His father had sent him and Tian out for the day, while he tended to something at the City Lord's Manor. Cal would pay for the break with late-night studying by stormlight, but no use explaining that to the other boys.
Cal said, "what were you all talking about?"
Rather than answering, Naggett said,
"Cal, you know things."
Light-haired and spindly, he was the tallest of the bunch.
"Don't you? About the world and the like?"
"Yeah,"
Cal said, scratching his head.
"Sometimes."
"You ever heard of a dark eyes becoming a light eyes?"
Naggett asked.
"Sure,"
Cal said.
"It can happen, father says. Wealthy dark-eyed merchants marry low-born light-eyes and join their family. Then maybe have light-eyed children, that sort of thing."
"No, not like that," Cab said.
He had low eyebrows and always seemed to have a perpetual scowl on his face.
"You know, real dark-eyes. Like us."
"Not like you," the tone seemed to imply. Cal's family were the only one of second none in the town. Everyone else was fourth or fifth, and Cal's rank made them uncomfortable around him. His father's strange profession didn't help either. It all left Cal feeling distinctly out of place.
"You know how it can happen," Cal said. "Ask Laurel. She was just talking about it. If a man wins a shard blade on the battlefield, his eyes become light."
"That's right," Laurel said. "Everybody knows it. Even a slave could become a light eyes if he won a shard blade."
The boys nodded. They all had brown, black, or other dark-colored eyes. Winning a shard blade was one of the main reasons common men went to war. In Boren kingdoms, everyone had a chance to rise. It was, as Cal's father would say, a fundamental tenet of their society.
"Yeah," said Naggett impatiently. "But have you ever heard of it happening? Not just in stories, I mean. Does it happen for real?"
"Sure," Cal said. "It must. Otherwise, why would so many men go to war?"
"Because," Jest said, "we've got to prepare men to fight for the Tranquiline Halls. We've got to send soldiers to the Heralds. The Ardents are always talking of it."
"In the same breath that they tell us it's all right to be a farmer, too," Cab said. "Like farming some lonely second place or something."
"Hey," Tift said, "my fa's a farmer, and he's right good at it. It's a noble calling. All your fa's are farmers."
"All right, fine," Jost said, "but we ain't talking of that. We're talking of shard bearers. You go to war, you can win a shard blade and become a light eyes. My fa, see, he should have been given that shard blade. But the man who was with him, he took it while my fa was knocked out. told the officer that he'd been the one to kill the shard-bearer, so he got the blade, and my fa—
He was cut off by Laurel's tinkling laughter. Cal frowned. That was a different kind of laughter than he normally heard from her, much more subdued and kind of annoying.
Jost, you're claiming your father won a shard blade? She said.
No, it was taken from him, the larger boy said.
Didn't your father fight in the waste scum skirmishes up north? Laurel said. Tell him, Kaladin.
She's right, Jost. There weren't any shard-bearers there, just Reshi raiders who thought they'd take advantage of the new king. They've never had any shard-blades. If your father saw one, he must have been remembering incorrectly.
Remembering incorrectly? Jost said.
Sure, Cal said quickly. I'm not saying he's lying, Jost. He just might have some trauma-induced hallucinations or something like that.
The boys grew silent, looking at Cal. One scratched his head.
Jost spat to the side. He seemed to be watching Laurel from the corner of his eye. She pointedly looked at Cal and smiled at him.
You always gotta make a man feel like an idiot, don't you, Cal? Jost said.
What?
No, I... You wanna make my fa sound like a fool? Jost said, face red. And you wanna make me sound stupid? Well, some of us ain't lucky enough to spend our days eating fruit and laying about. We've gotta work.
I don't...
Jost tossed the quarterstaff to Cal. He caught it awkwardly. Then Jost took the other staff from his brother.
You insult my fa, you get a fight. That's honor. You have honor, lordling?
I'm no lordling, Cal spat.
Stormfather Jost, I'm only a few non higher than you are.
Jost's eyes grew angrier at the mention of non. He held up his quarterstaff.
You going to fight me or not?
Anger spren began to appear in small pools at his feet, bright red. Cal knew what Jost was doing. It wasn't uncommon for the boys to look for a way to make themselves look better than him. Cal's father said it had to do with their insecurity. He'd have told Cal to just drop the quarterstaff and walk away. But Laurel was sitting right there, smiling at him. And men didn't become heroes by walking away.
All right. Sure.
Cal held up his quarterstaff. Jost swung immediately, more quickly than Cal had anticipated. The other boys watched with a mixture of glee, shock, and amazement. Cal barely managed to get his staff up. The lengths of wood cracked together, sending a jolt up Cal's arms. Cal was knocked off balance. Jost moved quickly, stepping to the side and swinging his staff down, hitting Cal in the foot. Cal cried out as a flash of agony lanced up his leg, and he released the staff with one hand and reached down. Jost swung his staff around and hit Cal's side. Cal gasped, letting the staff clatter to the stones and grabbing his side as he fell to his knees. He breathed out in huffing breaths, straining against the pain. Small spindly pain spren, glowing pale orange hand shapes, like stretching sinew or muscles, crawled from the stone around him. Cal dropped one hand to the stones, leaning forward as he held his side.
You'd better not have broken any of my ribs, you Kremling, he thought.
To the side, Laurel pursed her lips. Cal felt a sudden, overpowering shame. Jost lowered his staff, looking abashed.
Well, he said, you can see that my fa trained me right good. Maybe that will show you. The things he says are true and...
Cal growled in anger and pain, snatching his quarterstaff from the ground and leaping at Jost. The older boy cursed, stumbling backward as he raised his weapon. Cal bellowed, slamming his weapon forward. Something changed in that moment. Cal felt an energy as he held the weapon, an excitement that washed away his pain. He spun, smashing the staff into one of Jost's hands. Jost let go with that hand, screaming. Cal brought his weapon around and slammed it into the boy's side. Cal had never held a weapon before, never been in a fight any more dangerous than a wrestling match with Tien. But the length of wood felt right in his fingers. He was amazed by how wonderful the moment felt. Jost grunted, stumbling again, and Cal brought his weapon back around, preparing to smash Jost's face. He raised his staff, but then froze. Jost was bleeding from the hand Cal had hit. Just a little, but it was blood. He'd hurt someone.
Jost growled and lurched upright. Before Cal could protest, the larger boy swept Cal's legs from underneath him, sending him to the ground, knocking the breath from his lungs. That set afire the wound in his side, and the pain spren scampered across the ground, latching onto Cal's side, looking like an orange scar as they fed on Cal's agony. Jost stepped back. Cal lay on his back, breathing. He didn't know what to feel. Holding the staff in that moment had felt wonderful, incredible. At the same time, he could see Laurel to the side. She stood up and, instead of kneeling to help him, turned and walked away toward her father's mansion. Tears welled in Cal's eyes. With a shout, he rolled over and grabbed the quarterstaff again. He would not give in.
"None of that now," Jost said from behind. Cal felt something hard on his back, a boot shoving him down to the stone.
Jost took the staff from Cal's fingers.
"I failed. I lost."
He hated the feeling, hated it far more than the pain.
"You did well," Jost said grudgingly. "But leave off. I don't want to have to hurt you for real."
Cal bowed his head down, letting his forehead rest on the warm, sunlit rock. Jost removed his foot, and the boys withdrew, chatting, their boots scraping on rock. Cal forced himself to his hands and knees, then up onto his feet. Jost turned back, wary, holding his quarterstaff in one hand.
"Teach me," Cal said.
Jost blinked in surprise. He glanced at his brother.
"Teach me," Cal pled, stepping forward.
"I'll worm for you, Jost. My father gives me 2 hours off each afternoon. I'll do your work then if you'll teach me in the evenings what your father is teaching you with that staff."
He had to know, had to feel the weapon in his hands again, had to see if that moment he'd felt had been a fluke. Jost considered, then finally shook his head.
"Can't. Your fall would kill me. Get those surgeon's hands of yours all covered with calluses? Wouldn't be right."
He turned away.
"You go be what you are, Cal. I'll be what I am."
Cal stood for a long while, watching them go. He sat down on the rock. Laurel's figure was growing distant. There were some servants coming down the hillside to fetch her. Should he chase after her? His side still hurt, and he was annoyed at her for leading him down to the others in the first place. And above all, he was still embarrassed. He lay back down, emotions welling inside of him. He had trouble sorting through them.
"Kaladin?"
He turned, ashamed to find tears in his eyes, and saw Tian sitting on the ground behind him.
"How long have you been there?" Cal snapped.
Tian smiled, then set a rock on the ground. He climbed to his feet and hurried away, not stopping when Cal called after him. Grumbling, Cal forced himself to his feet and walked over to pick up the rock. It was another dull, ordinary stone. Tian had a habit of finding those and thinking they were incredibly precious. He had an entire collection of them back in the house. He knew where he'd found each one and could tell you what was special about it. With a sigh, Cal began walking back toward the town. "You go be what you are, I'll be what I am." His side smarted. Why hadn't he hit Jost when he'd had the chance? Could he train himself out of freezing in battle like that? He could learn to hurt. Couldn't he? Did he want to? "You go be what you are." What did a man do if he didn't know what he was, or even what he wanted to be? Eventually, he reached Hearthstone proper. The 100 or so buildings were set in rows, each one shaped like a wedge, with the low side pointing stormward. The roofs were of thick wood, tarred to seal out the rain. The northern and southern sides of the buildings rarely had windows, but the fronts, facing west away from the storms, were nearly all window. Like the plants of the Stormlands, the lives of men here were dominated by the high storms. Cal's home was near the outskirts. It was larger than most, built wide to accommodate the surgery room, which had its own entrance. The door was ajar, so Cal peeked in. He'd expected to see his mother cleaning, but instead found that his father had returned from Bright Lord Wistio's manor. Liren sat on the edge of the operating table, hands in his lap, bald head bowed. He held his spectacles in his hand, and he looked exhausted.
"Father?" Cal asked. "Why are you sitting in the dark?"
Liren looked up. His face was somber, distant.
"Father?"
Cal asked, growing more concerned.
"Bright Lord Wistio has been carried by the winds."
"He's dead?"
Cal was so shocked he forgot his side. Wistio had always been there. He couldn't be gone.
What of Laurel?
He was healthy just last week.
"He has always been frail, Cal," Liren said. "The Almighty calls all men back to the spiritual realm eventually."
"You didn't do anything?"
Cal blurted out. He regretted the words immediately.
"I did all I could," his father said, rising. "Perhaps a man with more training than I. Well, there is no use in regrets."
He walked to the side of the room, removing the black covering from the goblet lamp filled with diamond spheres. It lit the room immediately, blazing like a tiny sun.
"We have no city lord, then," Cal said, raising a hand to his head. "He had no son."
"Those in Kolinar will appoint us a new city lord," Liren said. "Almighty send them wisdom in the choice."
He looked at the goblet lamp. Those were the city lord's spheres. A small fortune. Cal's father put the covering right back on the goblet, as if he hadn't just removed it. The motion plunged the room back into darkness, and Cal blinked as his eyes adjusted.
"He's left these to us," Cal's father said. Cal started.
"What?"
"You're to be sent to Carbranth when you turn 16. These spheres will pay your way. Bright Lord Wistio requested it be done. A last act to care for his people. You will go and become a true master surgeon, then return to Hearthstone."
In that moment, Cal knew his fate had been sealed. If Bright Lord Wistio had demanded it, Cal would go to Carbranth. He turned and walked from the surgery room, passing out into the sunlight, not saying another word to his father. He sat down on the steps. What did he want? He didn't know. That was the problem. Glory, honor, the things Laurel had said, none of those really mattered to him. But there had been something there when he'd held the quarterstaff. And now, suddenly, the decision had been taken from him. The rocks Tien had given him were still in his pocket. He pulled them out, then took his canteen off his belt and washed them with water. The first one he'd been given showed the white swirls and strata. It appeared the other one had a hidden design, too. It looked like a face, smiling at him, made of white bits in the rock. Cal smiled despite himself, though it quickly faded. A rock wasn't going to solve his problems. Unfortunately, though he sat for a long while thinking, it didn't look like anything would solve his problems. He wasn't sure he wanted to be a surgeon, and he felt suddenly constricted by what life was forcing him to become. But that one moment holding the quarterstaff sang to him. A single moment of clarity in an otherwise confusing world.
XVII. A Bloody Red Sunset.
Might I be quite frank? Before you asked why I was so concerned, it is for the following reason.
"He's old,"
Syl said with awe, flitting around the apothecary.
"Really old. I didn't know men got this old. You sure he's not Decaespren, wearing a man's skin?"
Kaladin smiled as the apothecary shuffled forward with his cane, oblivious of the invisible windspren. His face was as full of chasms as the shattered plains themselves, weaving out in a pattern from his deeply recessed eyes.
He wore a pair of thick spectacles on the tip of his nose and was dressed in dark robes. Kaladin's father had told him of apothecaries, men who walked the line between herbalists and surgeons. Common people regarded the healing arts with enough superstition that it was easy for an apothecary to cultivate an arcane air. The wooden walls were draped with cloth griff wards, styled in cryptic patterns, and behind the counter were shelves with rows of jars. A full human skeleton hung in the far corner, held together by wires. The windowless room was lit with bundles of garnet spheres hanging from the corners. Despite all that, the place was clean and tidy. It had the familiar scent of antiseptic Kaladin associated with his father's surgery.
Ah, young bridgeman.
The short apothecary adjusted his spectacles. He stooped forward, running his fingers through his wispy white beard.
Come for a ward against danger, perhaps? Or maybe a young washwoman in the camp has caught your eye? I have a potion which, if slipped into her drink, will make her regard you with favor.
Kaladin raised an eyebrow. Syl, however, opened her mouth in an amazed expression.
You should give that to Gaz, Kaladin. It would be nice if he liked you more.
I doubt that's what it's intended for, Kaladin thought with a smile.
Young bridgeman?
The apothecary asked.
Is it a charm against evil you desire?
Kaladin's father had spoken of these things. Many apothecaries purveyed supposed love charms or potions to cure all manner of ailments. They'd contain nothing more than some sugar and a few pinches of common herbs to give them a spike of alertness or drowsiness, depending on the purported effect. It was all nonsense, though Kaladin's mother had put great stock in glyph wards. Kaladin's father had always expressed disappointment in her stubborn way of clinging to superstitions. I need some bandages, Kaladin said, and a flask of Lister's oil or knobweed sap. Also a needle and gut, if you have any. The apothecary's eyes opened wide in surprise. I'm the son of a surgeon, Kaladin admitted. Trained by his hand. He was trained by a man who had studied in the great concourse of Carbranth.
Ah,
the apothecary said.
Well,
he stood up straighter, setting aside his cane and brushing his robes.
Bandages, you said. And some antiseptic? Let me see.
He moved back behind the counter. Kaladin blinked. The man's age hadn't changed, but he didn't seem nearly as frail. His step was firmer and his voice had lost its whispering raspiness. He searched through his bottles, mumbling to himself as he read off his labels.
You could just go to the surgeon's hall. They would charge you far less.
Not for a bridgeman, Kaladin said, grimacing. He'd been turned away. The supplies there were for real soldiers.
I see,
the apothecary said, setting a jar on the counter, then bending down to poke in some drawers. Syl flitted over to Kaladin.
Every time he bends, I think he'll snap like a twig.
She was growing able to understand abstract thought, and at a surprisingly rapid pace.
I know what death is.
He still wasn't certain whether to feel sorry for her or not. Kaladin picked up the small bottle and undid the cork, smelling what was inside. Larmic mucus? He grimaced at the foul smell. That's not nearly as effective as the two I asked for.
But it's far cheaper,
the old man said, coming up with a large box. He opened the lid, revealing sterile white bandages.
And you, as has been noted, are a bridge man.
How much for the mucus, then? He'd been worried about this. His father had never mentioned how much his supplies cost.
2 blood marks for the bottle.
That's what you consider cheap?
Lister's oil costs 2 sapphire marks.
A knobweed sap? Kaladin said. I saw some reeds of it growing just outside of camp. It can't be that rare.
And do you know how much sap comes from a single plant?
The apothecary asked, pointing. Kaladin hesitated. It wasn't true sap, but a milky substance that you could squeeze from the stalks, or so his father had said.
No, Kaladin admitted.
A single drop, the man said. If you're lucky. It's cheaper than Lister's oil, sure, but more expensive than the mucus. Even if the mucus does stink like the Night Watcher's own backside.
I don't have that much, Kaladin said. It was 5 diamond marks to a garnet. 10 days' pay to buy 1 small jar of antiseptic.
Stormfather.
The apothecary sniffed.
The needle and gut will cost 2 clear marks. Can you afford that, at least?
Barely. How much for the bandages? 2 full emeralds?
They're just old scraps that I bleached and boiled. 2 clear chips in arm length.
I'll give you a mark for the box.
Very well.
Kaladin reached into his pocket to get the spheres as the old apothecary continued.
You surgeons, all the same, never give a blink to consider where your supplies come from. You just use them like there will be no end.
You can't put a price on a person's life, Kaladin said. One of his father's sayings. It was the main reason that Laren had never charged for his services. Kaladin brought out his 4 marks. He hesitated when he saw them, however. Only 1 was still glowing with its soft crystal light. The other 3 were dull, the bits of diamond barely visible at the center of the drops of glass.
Here now, the apothecary said, squinting. You trying to pass dun spheres off on me?
He snatched 1 before Kaladin could complain, then fished around under his counter. He brought up a jeweler's loop, removing his spectacles and holding the sphere up toward the light.
Ah, no, that's a real gemstone. You should get your spheres infused, Bridgman. Not everyone is as trusting as I am.
They were glowing this morning, Kaladin protested. Gaz must have paid me with rundown spheres. The apothecary removed his loop and replaced the spectacles. He selected 3 marks, including the glowing 1. Could I have that one? Kaladin asked. The apothecary frowned. Always keep a glowing sphere in your pocket, Kaladin said. It's good luck.
You certain you don't want a love potion?
If you get caught in the dark, you'll have light, Kaladin said tersely. Besides, as you said, most people aren't as trusting as you. Reluctantly, the apothecary traded the infused sphere for the dead 1, though he did check it with the loop to be certain. A dun sphere was worth just as much as an infused 1. All you had to do was leave it out in a high storm, and it would recharge and give off light for a week or so. Kaladin pocketed the infused sphere and picked up his purchase. He nodded farewell to the apothecary, and Syl joined him as he stepped out into the camp's street. He'd spent some of the afternoon listening to soldiers at the mess hall, and he'd learned some things about the war camps. Things he should have learned weeks ago, but had been too despondent to care about. He now knew about the chrysalises on the plateaus, the gem hearts they contained, and the competition between the high princes. He understood why Satius pushed his men so hard, and he was beginning to see why Satius turned around if they got to the plateau later than another army. That wasn't very common. More often, Satius arrived first, and the other Alethi armies that came up behind them had to turn back. The war camps were enormous. All told, there were over 100,000 troops in the various Alethi camps, many times the population of Hearthstone. And that wasn't counting the civilians. A mobile war camp attracted a large array of camp followers. Stationary war camps, like these on the Shattered Plains, brought even more. Each of the 10 war camps filled its own crater, and was filled with an incongruous mix of soul-cast buildings, shanties, and tents. Some merchants, like the apothecary, had the money to build a wooden structure. Those who lived in tents took them down for storms, then paid for shelter elsewhere. Even within the crater, the storm winds were strong, particularly where the outer wall was low or broken.
Some places, like the lumberyard, were completely exposed. The street bustled with the usual crowd. Women in skirts and blouses, the wives, sisters, or daughters of the soldiers, merchants, or craftsmen. Workers in trousers or overalls. A large number of soldiers in leathers, carrying spear and shield. All were Sadius's men. Soldiers of one camp didn't mix with those of another, and you stayed away from another Bright Lord's crater unless you had business there. Kaladin shook his head in dismay.
What?
Syl asked, settling on his shoulder.
I hadn't expected there to be so much discord among the camps here. I thought it would all be one king's army unified.
People are discord, Syl said.
What does that mean?
You all act differently and think differently. Nothing else is like that. Animals act alike, and all Sprenna are, in a sense, virtually the same individual. There's harmony in that, but not in you. It seems that no two of you can agree on anything. All the world does as it is supposed to, except for humans. Maybe that's why you so often want to kill each other.
But not all Windspren act alike, Kaladin said, opening the box and tucking some of the bandages into the pocket he'd sewn into the inside of his leather vest. You're proof of that.
I know, she said softly. Maybe now you can see why it bothers me so.
Kaladin didn't know how to respond to that. Eventually, he reached the lumberyard. A few members of Bridge Four lounged in the shade on the east side of their barrack. It would be interesting to see one of those barracks get made. They were soul-cast directly from air into stone. Unfortunately, soul-castings happened at night, and under strict guard to keep the holy rite from being witnessed by anyone other than Ardents or very high-ranking Light Eyes. The first afternoon bell sounded right as Kaladin reached the barrack, and he caught a glare from Gaz for nearly being late for bridge duty. Most of that duty would be spent sitting around waiting for the horns to blow. Well, Kaladin didn't intend to waste time. He couldn't risk tiring himself by carrying the plank, not when a bridge run could be imminent, but perhaps he could do some stretches or... A horn sounded in the air, crisp and clean. It was like the mythical horn that was said to guide the souls of the brave to heaven's battlefield. Kaladin froze. As always, he waited for the second blast, an irrational part of him needing to hear confirmation. It came, sounding a pattern indicating the location of the pupating chasm fiend. Soldiers began to scramble toward the staging area beside the lumberyard. Others ran into camp to fetch their gear.
"Line up!" Kaladin shouted, dashing up to the bridgemen. "Storm you, every man in a line!"
They ignored him. Some of the men weren't wearing their vests, and they clogged the barrack doorway, all trying to get in. Those who had their vests ran for the bridge. Kaladin followed, frustrated. Once there, the men gathered around the bridge in a carefully prearranged manner. Each man got a chance to be in the best position, running in front up to the chasm, then moving to the relative safety of the back for the final approach. There was a strict rotation, and errors were neither made nor tolerated. Bridge crews had a brutal system of self-management. If a man tried to cheat, the others forced him to run the final approach in front. That sort of thing was supposed to be forbidden, but Gaz turned a blind eye toward cheaters. He also refused bribes to let men change positions. Perhaps he knew that the only stability, the only hope, the bridgemen had was in their rotation. Life wasn't fair, being a bridgeman wasn't fair. But at least if you ran the death line and survived, the next time you got to run at the back. There was one exception. As bridge leader, Kaladin got to run in the front most of the way, then moved to the back for the assault. His was the safest position in the group, though no bridgeman was truly safe. Kaladin was like a moldy crust on a starving man's plate. Not the first bite, but still doomed. He got into position. Yake, Dunny, and Malop were the last stragglers. Once they'd taken their places, Kaladin commanded the men to lift.
He was half surprised to be obeyed, but there was almost always a bridge leader to give commands during a run. The voice changed, but the simple orders did not. Lift, run, lower. 20 bridges charged down from the lumberyard and toward the shattered plains. Kaladin noticed a group of bridgemen from Bridge 7 watching with relief. They'd been on duty until the first afternoon bell. They'd avoided this run by mere moments. The bridgemen worked hard. It wasn't just because of threats of beatings. They ran hard because they wanted to arrive at the target plateau before the Parshendi did. If they did so, there would be no arrows, no death. And so running their bridges was the one thing the bridgemen did without reservation or laziness. Though many hated their lives, they still clung to them with white-knuckled fervor. They clomped across the first of the permanent bridges. Kaladin's muscles groaned in protest at being worked again so soon, but he tried not to dwell on his fatigue. The high storm's rains from the night before meant that most plants were still open, rock buds spewing out vines, flowering branzas, reaching claw-like branches out of crevices toward the sky. There were also occasional prickle tacks, the needly, stone-limbed little shrubs Kaladin had noticed his first time through the area. Water pooled in the numerous crevices and depressions on the surface of the uneven plateau. Gaz called out directions, telling them which pathway to take. Many of the nearby plateaus had three or four bridges creating branching paths across the plains. The running became rote. It was exhausting, but it was also familiar. And it was nice to be at the front where he could see where he was going. Kaladin fell into his usual step-counting mantra, as he'd been advised to do by that nameless bridgeman whose sandals he still wore. Eventually, they reached the last of the permanent bridges. They crossed a short plateau, passing the smoldering ruins of a bridge the Parshendi had destroyed during the night. How had the Parshendi managed that, during a high storm? Earlier, while listening to the soldiers, he'd learned that the soldiers regarded the Parshendi with hatred, anger, and not a little awe. These Parshendi weren't like the lazy, nearly mute Parshmen who worked throughout Roshar. These Parshendi were warriors of no small skill. That still struck Kaladin as incongruous. Parshmen? Fighting? It was just so strange. Bridge 4 and the other crews got their bridges down, spanning a chasm where it was narrowest. His men collapsed to the ground around their bridge, relaxing while the army crossed. Kaladin nearly joined them. In fact, his knees nearly buckled in anticipation. No, he thought, steadying himself. No, I stand. It was a foolish gesture. The other bridgemen barely paid him any heed. One man, Moash, even swore at him. But now that Kaladin had made the decision, he stubbornly stuck to it, clasping his hands behind his back and falling into parade rest while watching the army cross.
"Oh, little bridgeman,"
a soldier called from among those waiting their turn.
"Curious at what real soldiers look like?"
Kaladin turned toward the man, a solid brown-eyed fellow with arms the size of many men's thighs. He was a squad leader, by the knots on the shoulder of his leather jerkin. Kaladin had borne those knots once.
"How do you treat your spear and shield, squad leader?"
Kaladin called back. The man frowned, but Kaladin knew what he was thinking. A soldier's gear was his life. You cared for your weapon as you cared for your children, often seeing to its upkeep before you took food or rest. Kaladin nodded to the bridge.
"This is my bridge," he said in a loud voice. "It is my weapon. The only one allowed me. Treat her well."
"Or you'll do what?"
called one of the other soldiers, prompting laughter among the ranks. The squad leader said nothing. He looked troubled. Kaladin's words were bravado. In truth, he hated the bridge. Still, he remained standing. A few moments later, High Prince Sarius himself crossed on Kaladin's bridge. Bright Lord Amaram had always seemed so heroic, so distinguished. A gentleman general. This Sarius was a different creature entirely, with that round face, curly hair, and lofty expression.
He rode as if he were in a parade, one hand lightly holding the reins before him, the other carrying his helm under his arm. His armor was painted red, and the helm bore frivolous tassels. There was so much pointless pomp that it nearly overshadowed the wonder of the ancient artifact. Kaladin forgot his fatigue and formed his hands into fists. Here was a light eyes he could hate even more than most. A man so callous that he threw away the lives of hundreds of bridgemen each month. A man who had expressly forbidden his bridgemen to have shields, for reasons Kaladin still didn't understand. Satius and his honor guard soon passed, and Kaladin realized that he probably should have bowed. Satius hadn't noticed, but it could have made trouble if he had. Shaking his head, Kaladin roused his bridge crew, though it took special prodding to get Rock, the large horn-eater, up and moving. Once across the chasm, his men picked up their bridge and jogged toward the next chasm. The process was repeated enough times that Kaladin lost count. At each crossing, he refused to lie down. He stood with hands behind his back, watching the army pass. More soldiers took note of him, jeering. Kaladin ignored them, and by the fifth or sixth crossing, the jeers faded. The one other time he saw Bright Lord Satius, Kaladin gave a bow, though it made his stomach twist to do so. He did not serve this man. He did not give this man allegiance. But he did serve his men of Bridge Four. He would save them, and that meant he had to keep himself from being punished for insolence.
"Reverse runners," Gaz called. "Cross and reverse."
Kaladin turned sharply. The next crossing would be the assault. He squinted, looking into the distance, and could just barely make out a line of dark figures gathering on another plateau. The Parshendi had arrived and were forming up. Behind them, a group worked on breaking open the chrysalis. Kaladin felt a spike of frustration. Their speed hadn't been enough. And, tired though they were, Satius would want to attack quickly before the Parshendi could get the gem heart out of its shell. The bridgemen rose from their rest, silent, haunted. They knew what was coming. They crossed the chasm and pulled the bridge over, then rearranged themselves in reverse order. The soldiers formed ranks. It was all so silent, like men preparing to carry a casket to the pyre. The bridgemen left a space for Kaladin at the back, sheltered and protected. Syl alighted on the bridge, looking at the spot. Kaladin walked up to it, so tired mentally and physically. He'd pushed himself too hard in the morning, then again by standing instead of resting. What had possessed him to do such a thing? He could barely walk. He looked over the bridgemen. His men were resigned, despondent, terrified. If they refused to run, they'd be executed. If they did run, they'd face the arrows. They didn't look toward the distant line of Parshendi archers. Instead, they looked down. "They are your men," Kaladin told himself. "They need you to lead them, even if they don't know it." "How can you lead from the rear?" He stepped out of line and rounded the bridge. Two of the men, Drahi and Teft, looked up in shock as he passed. The death point, the spot in the very center of the front, was being held by Rock, the beefy, tan-skinned horn-eater. Kaladin tapped him on the shoulder. "You're in my spot, Rock." The man glanced at him, surprised.
"But..."
"To the back with you." Rock frowned. Nobody ever tried to jump ahead in the order.
"You're Ersic, Lowlander," he said with his thick accent. "You wish to die? Why do you not just go leap into the chasm? That would be easier."
"I'm bridge leader. It's my privilege to run at the front. Go." Rock shrugged, but did as ordered, taking Kaladin's position at the back. Nobody said a word. If Kaladin wanted to get himself killed, who were they to complain? Kaladin looked over the bridgemen. "The longer we take to get this bridge down, the more arrows they can loose at us. Stay firm, stay determined, and be quick. Raise bridge!" The men lifted, inner rows moving underneath and situating themselves in rows of five across. Kaladin stood at the very front with a tall, stout man named Leighton to his left, a spindly man named Merc to his right. Adis and Coral were at the edges. Five men in front. The death line. Once all of the crews had their bridges up, Gaz gave the command.
Assault!
They ran, dashing alongside the standing ranks of the army, passing soldiers holding spears and shields. Some watched with curiosity, perhaps amused at the sight of the lowly bridgemen running so urgently to their deaths. Others looked away, perhaps ashamed of the lives it would cost to get them across that chasm. Kaladin kept his eyes forward, squelching that incredulous voice in the back of his mind, one that screamed he was doing something very stupid. He barreled toward the final chasm, focused on the Prashendi line. Figures with black and crimson skin holding bows. Syl flitted close to Kaladin's head, no longer in the form of a person, streaking like a ribbon of light. She zipped in front of him. The bows came up. Kaladin hadn't been at the death point during a charge this bad since his first day on the crew. They always put new men into rotation at the death point. That way, if they died, you didn't have to worry about training them. The Parshendi archers drew, aiming at five or six of the bridge crews. Bridge four was obviously in their sights. The bows loosed.
Tien!
Kaladin screamed, nearly mad with fatigue and frustration. He bellowed the name aloud, uncertain why, as a wall of arrows zipped toward him. Kaladin felt a jolt of energy, a surge of sudden strength, unanticipated and unexplained. The arrows landed. Merc fell without a sound, four or five arrows striking him, spraying his blood across the stones. Leighton dropped as well, and with him both Adis and Coral. Shafts struck the ground at Kaladin's feet, shattering, and a good half-dozen hit the wood around Kaladin's head and hands. Kaladin didn't know if he'd been hit. He was too flush with energy and alarm. He continued running, screaming, holding the bridge on his shoulders. For some reason, a group of Parshendi archers ahead lowered their bows. He saw their marbled skin, strange reddish or orange helms, and simple brown clothing. They appeared confused. Whatever the reason, it gained Bridge Four a few precious moments. By the time the Parshendi raised their bows again, Kaladin's team had reached the chasm. His men fell into line with the other bridge crews. There were only 15 bridges now. Five had fallen. They closed the gaps as they arrived. Kaladin screamed for the bridgemen to drop amid another spray of arrows. One sliced open the skin near his ribs, deflecting off the bone. He felt it hit, but didn't feel any pain. He scrambled around the side of the bridge, helping push. Kaladin's team slammed the bridge into place as a wave of Alethi arrows distracted the enemy archers. A troop of cavalry charged across the bridges. The bridgemen were soon forgotten. Kaladin fell to his knees beside the bridge as the others of his crew stumbled away, bloodied and hurt, their part in the battle over. Kaladin held his side, feeling the blood there.
Straight laceration, only about an inch long, not wide enough to be of danger.
It was his father's voice. Kaladin panted. He needed to get to safety. Arrows zipped over his head, fired by the Alethi archers.
Some people take lives. Other people save lives.
He wasn't done yet. Kaladin forced himself to his feet and staggered to where someone lay beside the bridge. It was a bridgeman named Hopper. He had an arrow through the leg. The man moaned, holding his thigh. Kaladin grabbed him under the arms and pulled him away from the bridge. The man cursed at the pain, dazed, as Kaladin towed him to a cleft behind a small bulge in the rock where Rock and some of the other bridgemen had sought shelter. After dropping off Hopper, the arrow hadn't hit any major arteries and he would be fine for a time yet. Kaladin turned and tried to rush back out onto the battlefield proper. He slipped, however, stumbling in his fatigue. He hit the ground hard, grunting.
Some take lives, some save lives.
He pushed himself to his feet, sweat dripping from his brow, and scrambled back toward the bridge, his father's voice in his ears. The next bridgeman he found, a man named Kurm, was dead. Kaladin left the body. Gadol had a deep wound in the side where an arrow had passed completely through him. His face was covered with blood from a gash on his temple, and he'd managed to crawl a short distance from the bridge. He looked up with frenzied black eyes, orange pain spren waving around him. Kaladin grabbed him under the arms and towed him away just before a thundering charge of cavalry trampled the place where he'd been lying. Kaladin dragged Gadol over to the cleft, noting two more dead. He did a quick count. That made 29 bridgemen, including the dead he'd seen. 5 were missing. Kaladin stumbled back out onto the battlefield. Soldiers had bunched up around the back of the bridge, archers forming at the sides and firing into the Parshendi lines as the heavy cavalry charge, led by High Prince Sadius himself, virtually indestructible in his shard plate, tried to push the enemy back. Kaladin wavered, dizzy, dismayed at the sight of so many men running, shouting, firing arrows and throwing spears. 5 bridgemen, probably dead, lost in all of that. He spotted a figure huddled just beside the chasm lip, with arrows flying back and forth over his head. It was Dabid, one of the bridgemen. He curled up, arm twisted at an awkward angle. Kaladin charged in. He threw himself to the ground and crawled beneath the zipping arrows, hoping that the Parshendi would ignore a couple of unarmed bridgemen. Dabid didn't even notice when Kaladin reached him. He was in shock, lips moving soundlessly, eyes dazed. Kaladin grabbed him awkwardly, afraid to stand up too high lest an arrow hit him. He dragged Dabid away from the edge in a clumsy half-crawl. He kept slipping on blood, falling, abrading his arms on the rock, hitting his face against the stone. He persisted, towing the younger man out from underneath the flying arrows. Finally, he got far enough away that he risked standing. He tried to pick up Dabid, but his muscles were so weak. He strained and slipped, exhausted, falling to the stones. He lay there, gasping, the pain of his side finally washing over him. So tired. He stood up shakily, then tried again to grab Dabid. He blinked away tears of frustration, too weak to even pull the man.
Ersic Lowlander, a voice growled.
Kaladin turned as Rock arrived. The massive horn-eater grabbed Dabid under the arms, pulling him.
Crazy, he grumbled to Kaladin,
but easily lifted the wounded bridgeman and carried him back to the hollow. Kaladin followed. He collapsed in the hollow, his back to the rock. The surviving bridgeman huddled around him, eyes haunted. Rock set Dabid down.
4 more, Kaladin said between gasps. We have to find them.
Merc and Leighton, Teft said.
The older bridgeman had been near the back this run and hadn't taken any wounds.
And Adis and Coral. They were in the front.
That's right, Kaladin thought, exhausted. How could I forget?
Merc is dead, he said. The others might live.
He tried to stumble to his feet.
Idiot,
Rock said.
Stay here. Is all right. I will do this thing.
He hesitated.
Guess I'm an idiot too.
He scowled but went back out onto the battlefield. Teft hesitated, then chased after him. Kaladin breathed in and out, holding his side. He couldn't decide if the pain of the arrow impact hurt more than the cut.
Save lives.
He crawled over to the 3 wounded. Hobber, with an arrow through the leg, would wait, and Dabid had only a broken arm. Gadol was the worst off, with that hole in his side. Kaladin stared at the wound. He didn't have an operating table. He didn't even have antiseptic. How was he supposed to do anything? He shoved despair aside.
One of you go fetch me a knife, he told the bridgeman. Take it off the body of a soldier who has fallen. Someone else build a fire.
The bridgemen looked at each other.
Dunny, you get the knife,
Kaladin said as he held his hand to Gadol's wound, trying to staunch the blood.
Narm, can you make a fire?
With what?
The man asked. Kaladin pulled off his vest and shirt, then handed the shirt to Narm.
Use this as tinder and gather some fallen arrows for wood. Does anyone have flint and steel?
Moash did, fortunately. You carried anything valuable you had with you on a bridge run. Other bridgemen might steal it if you left it behind.
Move quickly, Kaladin said. Someone else go rip open a rock bud and get me the water goat inside.
They stood for a few moments. Then, blessedly, they did as he demanded. Perhaps they were too stunned to object. Kaladin tore open Gadol's shirt, exposing the wound. It was bad. Terribly bad. If it had cut the intestines, or some of the other organs. He ordered one of the bridgemen to hold a bandage to Gadol's forehead to staunch the smaller blood flow there. Anything would help. And inspected the wounded side with the speed his father had taught him. Dunny returned quickly with a knife. Narm was having trouble with the fire, though. The man cursed, trying his flint and steel again. Gadol was spasming. Kaladin pressed bandages to the wound, feeling helpless. There wasn't a place he could make a tourniquet for a wound like this. There wasn't anything he could do, but... Gadol spit up blood, coughing.
They break the land itself,
he hissed, eyes wild.
They want it, but in their rage they will destroy it. Like the jealous man burns his rich things rather than let them be taken by his enemies. They come.
He gasped, and then he fell still, his dead eyes staring upward, bloody spittle running in a trail down his cheek. His final haunting words hung over them. Not far away, soldiers fought and screamed, but the bridgemen were silent. Kaladin sat back, stunned, as always, by the pain of losing someone. His father had always said that time would dull his sensitivity. In this, Lirin had been wrong. He felt so tired. Rock and Teft were hurrying back toward the cleft in the rock, burying a body between them.
They wouldn't have brought anyone unless he was still alive, Kaladin told himself. Think of the ones you can help.
Keep that fire going, he said, pointing at Narm. Don't let it die. Someone heat the blade in it.
Narm jumped, noticing it for the first time that he'd actually managed to get a small flame started. Kaladin turned away from the dead Gadol and made room for Rock and Teft. They deposited a very bloody Leighton on the ground. He was breathing shallowly and had two arrows sticking from him, one from the shoulder, the other from the opposite arm. Another had grazed his stomach, and the cut there had been widened by movement. It looked like his left leg had been trampled by a horse. It was broken, and he had a large gash where the skin had split.
The other three are dead, Teft said. He nearly is, too. Nothing much we can do, but you said to bring him, so...
Kaladin knelt down immediately, working with careful, efficient speed. He pressed a bandage against the side, holding it in place with his knee, then tied a quick bandage on the leg, ordering one of the soldiers to hold it firm and elevate the limb.
"Where's that knife?"
Kaladin yelled, hurriedly tying a loose tourniquet around the arm. He needed to stop the blood right now. He'd worry about saving the arm later. Youthful Dunny rushed over with the heated blade. Kaladin lifted the side bandage and quickly cauterized the wound there. Leighton was unconscious, his breathing growing more shallow.
You will not die, Kaladin muttered. You will not die.
His mind was numb, but his fingers knew the motions. For a moment he was back in his father's surgery room, listening to careful instruction. He cut the arrow from Leighton's arm, but left the one in his shoulder, then sent the knife back to be reheated. Pete finally returned with the water gourd. Kaladin snatched it, using it to clean the leg wound, which was the nastiest, as it had been caused by trampling. When the knife came back, Kaladin pulled the arrow free of the shoulder and cauterized the wound as best he could, then used another of his quickly disappearing bandages to tie the wound. He splinted the leg with arrow shafts, the only thing they had. With a grimace, he cauterized the wound there, too. He hated to cause so many scars, but he couldn't afford to let any more blood be lost. He was going to need antiseptic. How soon could he get some of that mucus?
Don't you dare die, Kaladin said,
barely conscious that he was speaking. He quickly tied off the leg wound, then used his needle and thread to sew the arm wound. He bandaged it, then untied the tourniquet most of the way. Finally, he settled back, looking at the wounded man, completely drained. Layton was still breathing. How long would that last? The odds were against him. The bridgeman stood or sat around Kaladin, looking strangely reverent. Kaladin tiredly moved over to Haber and saw to the man's leg wound. It didn't need to be cauterized. Kaladin washed it out, cut away some splinters, then sewed it. There were pain sprin all around the man, tiny orange hands stretching up from the ground. Kaladin sliced off the cleanest portion of bandage he'd used on Gattol and tied it around Haber's wound. He hated the uncleanliness of it, but there was no other choice. Then he set Dabid's arm with some arrows he had the other bridgeman fetch, using Dabid's shirt to tie them in place. Then, finally, Kaladin sat back against the lip of stone, letting out a long, fatigued breath. Bangs of metal on metal and shouts of soldiers rang from behind. He felt so tired. Too tired to even close his eyes. He just wanted to sit and stare at the ground forever. Teft settled down beside him. The grizzled man had the water gourd, which still had some liquid in the bottom.
Drink, lad. You need it.
We should clean the wounds of the other men, Kaladin said numbly. They took scrapes. I saw some had cuts, and they should...
Drink, Teft said, his crackly voice insistent.
Kaladin hesitated, then drank the water. It tasted strongly bitter, like the plant from which it had been taken.
Where'd you learn to heal men like that? Teft asked.
Several of the nearby bridgemen turned toward him at the question.
I wasn't always a slave, Kaladin whispered.
These things you did, they won't make a difference, Rock said, walking up.
The massive horn-eater squatted down.
Gaz makes us leave behind wounded who cannot walk. He's standing order from above.
I'll deal with Gaz, Kaladin said, resting his head back against the stone.
Go return that knife to the body you took it off. I don't want to be accused of thievery. Then when the time comes to leave, I want two men in charge of Layton and two men in charge of Haber. We'll tie them to the top of the bridge and carry them. At the chasms, you'll have to move quickly and untie them before the army crosses, then retie them at the end. We'll also need someone to lead Dabit if his shock hasn't passed.
Gaz won't stand for this thing, Rock said.
Kaladin closed his eyes, declining further argument. The battle was a long one. As evening approached, the Parshendi finally retreated, jumping away across the chasms with their unnaturally powerful legs. There was a chorus of shouts from the Alethi soldiers who had won the day. Kaladin forced himself to his feet and went looking for Gaz. It would be a while yet before they could get the chrysalis open. It was like pounding on stone. But he needed to deal with the bridge sergeant. He found Gaz watching from well behind the battle lines. He glanced at Kaladin with his one eye.
How much of that blood is yours?
Kaladin looked down, realizing for the first time that he was crusted with dark flaking blood, most belonging to the men he'd worked on. He didn't answer the question.
We're taking our wounded with us.
Gaz shook his head.
If they can't walk, they stay behind. Standing orders. Not my choice.
We're taking them, Kaladin said. No more firm, no more loud.
Bright Lord Lamoral won't stand for it.
Lamoral was Gaz's immediate superior.
You'll send Bridge Four last to lead the wounded soldiers back to camp. Lamoral won't go with that troop. He'll go on ahead with the main body as he won't want to miss Sadius's victory feast.
Gaz opened his mouth. My men will move quickly and efficiently, Kaladin said, interrupting him. They won't slow anyone. He took the last sphere from his pocket and handed it over.
You won't say anything.
Gaz took the sphere, snorting.
One clear mark. You think that will make me take a risk this big?
If you don't, Kaladin said, voice calm. I will kill you and let them execute me.
Gaz blinked in surprise.
You'd never...
Kaladin took a single step forward. He must have looked a dreadful sight, covered in blood. Gaz paled. Then he cursed, holding up the dark sphere.
And a dun sphere at that.
Kaladin frowned. He was sure it had still glowed before the bridge run.
That's your fault. You gave it to me.
Those spheres were newly infused last night, Gaz said. They came straight from Brightlord Sadeus's treasurer. What did you do with them?
Kaladin shook his head, too exhausted to think. Syl landed on his shoulder as he turned to walk back to the bridgeman.
What are they to you? Gaz called after him. Why do you even care?
They're my men.
He left Gaz behind.
I don't trust him,
Syl said, looking over her shoulder.
He could just say you threatened him and send men to arrest you.
Maybe he will, Kaladin said. I guess I just have to count on him wanting more of my bribes.
Kaladin continued on, listening to the shouts of the victors and the groans of their wounded. The plateaus were littered with corpses, bunched up along the edges of the chasm where the bridges had made a focus for the battle. The Parshendi, as always, had left their dead behind. Even when they won, they reportedly left their dead. The humans sent back bridge crews and soldiers to burn their dead and send their spirits to the afterlife, where the best among them would fight in the Herald's army.
Spheres,
Syl said, still looking at Gaz.
That doesn't seem like much to count on.
Maybe. Maybe not. I've seen the way he looks at them. He wants the money I give him. Perhaps badly enough to keep him in line.
Kaladin shook his head.
What you said earlier is right. Men are unreliable in many things. But if there's one thing you can count on, it's their greed. It was a bitter thought, but it had been a bitter day. A hopeful, bright beginning, and a bloody red sunset.